Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 21st of May. The days are getting longer and it looks like the start of summer is finally here. We've had Sweden win the Eurovision again, and Loreen a second time, making her the second person to win it twice. What else has gone on this week? Harry harangued in New York, Kev. What do you make of that on the headlines?
What a load of crap. They made a big deal of nothing. It's not good, but BBC headlines. The press are doing XYZ. Unbelievable. Even the mayor came out and said if they'd been chased for even 10 minutes in New York City, there would have been major problems. So to say that they've been chased for 2 hours or 90 minutes or however long it was, what a load of...
I think the fact that he can't pay for his own private security when he's all around the world, he's just trying to highlight just how much of a problem it is and made a mountain out of a molehill, really. I think in reality, this is just a kind of a way of him saying, look, we're not your normal kind of celebrity couple. We're way above that. And like, we need our own private security here. But it makes me laugh. There's actually in today's paper, there's like a big, we had a 2-hour run round in Manhattan. We had to get out, go to a fire department, go to a taxi, get in a public taxi and all this. Like, it was just like, it's almost like wacky racist stuff.
Yeah. No, I have minus sympathy, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
So maybe that's wrong, but yeah.
Yeah, big news this week.
He's made his bed, let him lie in it.
Yeah, big news this week, and it's a bit of an EU Brexit flex for sure. The UK ministers are pushing the EU to postpone post-Brexit trade rules, fearing they could disrupt plans to manufacture EV in the UK and jeopardise thousands of jobs. Stellantis, the parent company of Vauxhall, warned it couldn't keep its commitment to produce EVs in the UK due to upcoming EU-wide rules of origin resulting in prohibitive tariff on exports. Stellantis has urged modification to the Brexit trade, or the TCA, to delay these rules. So basically, under the TCA, from next year, 45% of an electric car's value should originate in the EU or UK to qualify for trade without tariffs, with higher requirements for batteries. Without meeting the requirements, cars manufactured in the UK would face a 10% tariff, making domestic production and exports uncompetitive with cars built within the EU or countries such as Japan and South Korea. I mean, what did you make of this news?
Not surprised. Brexit was just a complete disaster. And now we're just seeing the disasters come in one after the other. I think the EU puts itself in a difficult position because I think the EU is going to be in the same boat. So a lot of car manufacturing is not going to take place in the EU. So I think they're going to have to probably step back. But yeah, it's bananas again. The whole thing's crazy. There was no such thing as a clean break or a clean divorce, obviously, in terms of this. And this just proves it even more, and it won't be the last thing.
I mean, there was some news late Friday that broke that Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor, hinted at a possible deal between the UK government and Tata Jaguar Land Rover, JLR, for a new gigafactory in Somerset. Obviously, he was trying to keep, because they were talking about moving to Spain. It's still pending between the UK and Spain for the factory's location, but obviously government insiders are hopeful about JLR choosing Somerset, which I think would be an absolute game changer, because we need to protect our car manufacturing industry for sure, don't we? Because it's been decimated in the last sort of 20 years.
No, we need to make things.
Yeah.
You know, the world in perpetuity needs to make things. We basically shifted making things off to the Far East, China and the rest of the Far East.
Yeah.
And Eastern Europe, and we don't make anything anymore, and neither does the US, and most of Europe doesn't make much stuff either. So
yeah,
if you don't have things, then you're in a bit of a problem, aren't you?
Well, it's GDP, isn't it, at the end of the day? I mean, I think car manufacturing is only something like 5 to 6% of our total GDP, so where it used to be in the region of 20 to 25%, so it's been absolutely hammered.
Yeah, that has been out, but that's labour costs ultimately. If you got cheaper labour costs in the rest of the world, then that is going to happen.
So do you think that's going to benefit companies like, you know, ALK and TM1, in the sense that, you know, that the government have now recognised that they need to start building more gigafactories in the UK? Otherwise, they're going to get penalised and manufacturing is going to move elsewhere. So how can we do it? why don't they have the foresight to say, right, we're going to build this? Yes, they've already announced one up in Tyneside, and obviously we want to just get as many as possible, right? And I think they need something like 60 gigafactories by the end of 2029 to satisfy this this, you know, the full manufacturers going on. Quite a lot of manufacturers announced by 2030 they're going to have a complete EV fleet.
I think the governments in most countries are just not smart enough, to be honest. They take too long and don't make these decisions quick enough when we have to make business decisions pretty quickly normally. So especially when these things take a number of years to put into place. To answer your question, ALK effectively is going to be the supplier of the gigafactories, isn't it? With the lithium hydroxide, I think it is, or lithium something or other. And TM1 is effectively going to be the way of keeping the black mass and the renewables in this country by having the TM1 basically to bring the batteries back and bring the black mass back. You're going to be having a closed economy then, aren't you, in the UK, yeah, in terms of being able to keep that lithium and precious metals within the UK to then feed the next generation of cars or batteries or whatever else. I think TM1 has a business no matter what the government decides from this point on.
Yeah.
I think ALK or Alchemy is still in the drawing board because they don't have the cash to do the things.
Yeah.
Whereas TM1 is just further down the line in that situation. So, you know, if I was a betting man in terms of share performance, TM1 could easily do much better just simply because it's ready to go. It's ready to rock the world. Some may argue differently, but I think that is the truth. They're going to be revenue generated within a few weeks.
Yeah.
And next week, we're going to go and visit the site again, I think, along with a few other things that we're doing. So, yeah, it's interesting times, but really the government's got to pull its finger out, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's the same with the precious metals of whatever description you want to call, you know, or critical metals as they're calling them. You know, the UK government has got to understand that there are many UK listed companies all over that are going all over the world to try and get these resources. And they could basically ring fence those resources for themselves and help those companies. Yeah. You know, to get copper, to get nickel, to get lithium. I mean, TM1's a perfect example. I think it's either about to start or has started the drilling in Ireland for lithium, you know, through TM1. And they had big clumps of spodumite or whatever.
I mean, unless their mates are involved or their mates are running a company, it seems they're not interested in a lot of these MPs unless they're giving their mates backhanders. That's how it feels a lot of the time. So I don't know. It's a difficult one. I just wish they had the foresight rather than waiting until it's too late and having to outsource it from someone else and import it. You know, why don't they have this foresight to sit down and go, what are we going to need in the next 5 to 10 years or even shorter term? Build these gigafactories. As you say, start investing in these companies that have got the tin, got the tungsten, got, you know, all these important metals that we're going to need for the future of the world and, you know, to decarbonize and for greenification and actually start doing something, you know, unhindered.
Yeah. Absolutely. But interestingly enough, I think what they're trying to do is continually protect their backsides. And that leads me on to risk management, which they're very much into.
Yeah, I was actually going to talk about one other thing. It's a good segue that into another piece as well. This security expert's warning of a potential quantum apocalypse where an advanced quantum computer could hack into any online device or server within minutes, exposing personal critical infrastructures. Quantum computers, which can perform multiple tasks at once, may be capable of breaking all current web security and encryption. I mean, this is frankly frightening if you look at it. But as you say, Kev, this segues nicely into this week's guest and a company who offer GRC with cyber risk management featuring heavily on their agenda. Today, we're joined by Kerry Chambers, COO of Acuity Risk Management. Kerry joined Acuity in April 2021 as a commercial director and has since played a pivotal role in the company's growth and success. Under her leadership, Acuity has seen significant improvements across all key performance indicators, with impressive sales and marketing strategies being implemented. Kerry's efforts have not only led to substantial growth for Acuity, but also garnered recognition from prestigious industry schemes such as the National Technology Awards. With her extensive experience in growing and transforming SaaS software companies, Kerry brings a wealth of knowledge to her new role. She's proven track record in building high-performing teams, negotiating major contracts, and developing strategic initiatives. Kerry's expertise will be instrumental in expanding Acuity's presence in North America, a key market that represents 45% of the world's market share. Welcome, Kerry.
Good morning.
Firstly, congratulations on being appointed Chief Operating Officer of Acuity Risk Management.
Thank you. Yeah, very excited. Looking forward to transitioning into this role with our investment transaction with Acuity Risk Management Group. Really looking forward to this year.
So for those listeners who don't know who and what Arm are, being effectively Drums operating business, do you want to tell the listeners more, please?
Yeah, so Drums was 25% shareholder of Acuity Risk Management Limited. And we've just completed the transaction whereby Drums, which will become Acuity Risk Management Group, is now 100% owner of Acuity Risk Management. We are a subsidiary of Acuity Risk Management Group. So we are the operating business for Acuity Risk Management Group.
And what exactly is it that Acuity Risk Management does for the listeners?
Yeah, so Acuity Risk Management, we have a platform, a SaaS platform, and the market name of the platform is Stream. And it is a SaaS platform that provides integrated risk management solutions for businesses, for them to be able to centralize and then manage risk within their organization to understand where their exposure is, what that exposure might be costing their business, to apply reasonable controls to those risks in all parts of the business. So not just, we specialize with cyber risk management because our founders were very experienced risk managers from the cyber risk management space, but actually the Stream platform can look after all, help organizations manage all areas of risk within the organization. So there's cyber risk management, enterprise risk management, privacy and risk management around data privacy, third party supply chain type of risk management as well.
So for us uneducated people in this tech thing, what's a SaaS? What does it stand for?
Yep.
What does it do? Why do we need it? Why do you exist? Sorry for asking such wide questions, but it's like I'm sitting here going, I don't know what this is all about. So just for the listeners, tell us exactly what it is.
Yes.
And why.
There's actually two ways that you can use the Stream platform. One is the SaaS platform. So SaaS stands for software as a service. So that's where the platform is a service that you just access via the browser. All of your information is there via the browser. It's held in the cloud, in data centers, which we manage and operate. And that's basically a SaaS platform, something that, you know, you just access via the cloud. We also offer our customers the ability to purchase subscriptions on-premise. So on-premise means that you are given installable software. So you as the customer would install the software licenses onto servers in your own data center and you manage the security around that. So organizations that might want on-premise subscriptions and software would be those that have got much higher security requirements. So defense organizations, you know, military, BI, that type of organization, police forces and so on, that need to sit behind a firewall and can't really operate in public cloud types of situations. They might want same software, but they need what we call on-premise. So we offer our customers both of those options. But typically, I'm going to say 90% of our customers will go with our cloud solution, a SaaS platform, the version of Stream. The reason that's better for organizations is that they don't have to then worry about making sure that the license is up to date, installing upgrades, installing fixes, patches, or whatever might, you know, that might be released by our development team. SaaS services are, you know, completely on the latest version of the software all the time. And, you know, we manage the delivery and the uptime of that service for our customers.
Okay, so this is software as a service instead of buying the software. Like I would have bought Microsoft whatever or whatever program and installed it on my computer and then used it. Now
correct.
I'm basically buying the service. I'm not owning the software myself. And this is the process that the companies are going through.
Yeah, 100%. So yes, years ago, you would have bought, you know, your licenses with license keys for Microsoft Word or whatever that might, you know, whichever product you'd bought, and you would install that onto your device and you would have a license for a certain amount of time. In the world of technology now, most organizations will operate with a cloud service. So now Microsoft would sell you access to Office 365 and you pay them a subscription annually, and you log in with your credentials and you have access to the Microsoft products that, you know, your subscriptions entitles you to have access to. And that's their cloud service, their software as a service. And essentially we do that with Stream. But for customers that are not able to use that cloud service, we offer the installable software that you talked about just a minute.
Yeah, so that's the on-premises, if you like. So in other words, and because they want a heightened level of security. Tell us, what type of companies then are you aiming at for, and who needs this and why do they need it?
Yeah, I can talk. So we work very well in highly regulated environments. So organizations that, you know, are regulated themselves, we're seeing globally increasing government intervention in terms of regulations. And so there's a real rising need for risk management to be in place in those organizations that have got regulators in order to demonstrate their compliance to various legislation around the world. But I mean, we work across all markets because all organizations will be looking at risk within their organization and what their exposure is. But if we were to say, you know, where is our sweet spot, I guess it's those organizations that are considered CNI, which is critical national infrastructure. So, you know, transport, banking, anything, you know, those types of organizations that would be considered CNI, we do very well with those. But anything that's very regulated, that's got to answer to their own regulation authority, would require good, defensible risk management software solution.
So how does it, I mean, I get the risk management side thing, but how does the software work? Does it, I mean, obviously without giving away too many trade secrets, does it work on algorithms and rules, or is it kind of some sort of AI in there that says, well, we need to accept that this is the way we do this and mitigate the risk of this happening? Does it look at all sort of possibilities?
Yeah. So there are algorithms in the back of the software. So what will happen is, so typically when customers come to us, and if they're not using another solution, they may have been managing their risk within the organization on spreadsheets, for example. So they'll have lots and lots of risk registers for different parts of the organization, and those risk registers will have, you know, controls that they might apply to certain risks. So let's take a very basic one. You know, the risk is that we've got, I don't know, 100 retail sites, and the risk is there might be a fire in those retail sites. So controls, basic controls, could be fire extinguishers, sprinkler systems, alarms, things like that. And every control that you add to that, those risks, reduces the financial exposure or that you have for that particular risk. So what Stream does is it takes organizational risks, aligns them with their controls, and then will allow organizations to see perhaps if they were to invest in different sets of controls, how that then sits alongside their tolerance for risk in the organization. And so in the back of Stream, we have a data model that we develop and continue to run for our customers, that makes that process of all those calculations that go into across an organization, spitting out, you know, a number for tolerance. We provide that data set for our customer, and that's all in the back end of Stream. But the configure, I mean, it makes it sound quite basic there, but if you think of, let's look at cybersecurity. There's lots of different standards, frameworks globally around the world. So if we're looking at information security, I mean, here in the UK, we would be looking at ISO 27001 and that particular framework. And that has a set of controls built into that framework. In the US, they lean more towards a framework called NIST, which is very similar, but not the same. And so in Stream, an organization, a global organization, may want to make sure that they are meeting the requirements of both ISO and NIST. So we would map those controls to each framework so that they know which ones are crossover and they know how they're meeting requirements of those different frameworks and so on. So it does become very complex. And So our differentiator is in the data model that we have in the back end of Stream, and being able to quantify for organizations using various different algorithms that are built in what that financial risk exposure is to the organization.
Very good. So this is why, and for what reason, how does Acuity make money from these things?
How does Acuity make money from the software?
Yep, from the software and any ongoing services it provides.
Yeah, we provide our customers typically with multi-year contracts, subscriptions to the software service. So typically those run for 36 months. And so we will size those software subscriptions based on the number of users, for example, that they require to have access to Stream. And then we set those fees that are renewable for that 36-month term. So that allows us to understand what our forward contracted revenue would be from those customers. So we know what, you know, subscriptions are coming through each month for a term of 36 months. And then alongside the software subscriptions, we sell various different services from our consulting team. So that could, well, with all of our new customers, that would be implementation services. So making sure that the software is configured for the use case that the customer has come to us with, and that's for implementation. But post-implementation, when they're in what we call a BAU, business as usual situation, they may then have new use cases within the organization that they want to use Stream from. So if their initial use case had been managing IT security, their vendor management team wants to join, their risk registers and controls and things will be slightly different. So we would configure Stream for that, so we can have additional services through the life of the contract. We also offer services for people to make sure that their risk management practices are where they want them to be within the organization, that they're using Stream. You know, so if they've been a customer of ours for, say, 10 years, risk management processes maybe have changed. So we can offer sort of 2 and 3 day consulting services for us to go in and have a look at how their documentation is set up within Stream and within their organization, make recommendations for additional services that we can add on to that. Then we've got training services for new users, for risk management and so on, that we can add on through the life of the contract.
So from the perspective of what you've seen over the last period of time since you joined Acuity, have you seen an uptick in number of customers and also the amount of money spent per customer?
Sure, we have done. So when I joined Acuity, I was focusing on the way that our commercial teams were set up internally. So when I joined Acuity, for example, our marketing was outsourced. We had an agency that was running our marketing. So we looked at the marketing strategy and brought that back in-house, started to look at so that we had some KPIs and metrics from our campaigns, for example, and where our customers were coming from. We also, so that was marketing technology. We also looked at our revenue intelligence technology so that we could start to track, because there was no data that we could really use to track average deal sizes and things like that. So since we started measuring that, we have seen pipeline of prospect customers has grown significantly, and we are attracting, you know, both quantity and quality of prospects into our sales pipeline. And then as they move through the pipeline, we have seen then the average annual subscription increase as well alongside that. So we are able now to offer customers subscriptions that are sized to what they're actually looking for in terms of use case and user numbers and so on.
And when you get the companies into the pipeline, what sort of percentage are you managing to convert in terms of becoming customers?
Yeah, so once they're in, so there's various conversion rates that we track through from them not knowing about Acuity right through to them becoming a customer. But in answering your question, once they're in the pipeline, we're converting 80% of the customers that we've made it to our business development managers, 80% of those were close to become customers.
Wow, that's very good. No, this has got to be a extremely positive view. And I mean, in terms of, you said a 3-year contract, do you have any notion of the retention, the likely retention of customers for longer than that period of time?
Yeah, so we do very well on our retention and renewals. So when I joined, the renewal rate was, I think, 84%, 82%. And so one of the other things alongside the marketing strategy that was changed, one of the other things that I focused on was that kind of customer satisfaction and customer retention. So we made some changes internally so that our, we call them client partners, but essentially our account management team was focused purely on making sure our customers were using the software, they were seeing value from the software. And so our renewal rate has now gone up to 96%. So it was 82% when I joined. At the end of this financial year, it was 96%. NRR, which is looking at obviously retention and renewal and upsell, is at 126%. So quite above market expectations.
Very good. So that means as they're renewing, they're increasing what they're spending as well?
Yeah. So they're during the life of the contract, they're renewing, but yes, they're increasing. So there's been upsells during that. It could be during the life of the contract or at the point of renewal.
Or at the point of renewal again. And then they're going to be renewed for 3 years again at each time. It's not another 1 year.
Yeah. So when customers are at end of contract renewals, we then want to work with them to get them onto another 3 year deal.
Yeah. So from a company point of view, that gives you great visibility for revenues for the future.
Absolutely. So with the multi-year terms, we have a predictable forward contracted revenue. So we know what to expect for a minimum of those 36 months. And so we are tracking that monthly number, and we internally are trying to, obviously by adding new customers to that or upselling into those existing customers, increase that monthly revenue rate, but we're aware of that and how that amortizes over the 3 years of each customer's contract.
And the hope is to get what sort of annualized growth in terms of that revenue figure?
Yeah, so this year we're targeting a 38% increase for revenue.
Okay, very good. So some good in-depth detail there in terms of what we're expecting in terms of revenue. And obviously, from the point of view of Drums, purchasing the rest of Acuity, they've obviously done this with the expectation that Acuity is going to grow and maybe move into different markets as well. So what sort of expectations can you see in terms of growth, either of different markets, different companies, maybe more into defense, etc., etc.? I mean, what can you see happening over the next year or two?
So GRC, or the GRC market, which is the market that we're in, the governance, regulation and compliance, 45% of the global revenue for that market comes from the US. So when you look at Acuity's numbers, only 15% of our annual revenue comes from our US client base. So we've got lots of room for growth at the US market. And given that that has 45% of the GRC market globally, you know, we see huge amounts of opportunity in the US market. It's not the only place to grow, but that's where our focus will be for the next 12 to 18 months. And we're going to do that in two routes to market. So we're going to do that with a direct route to market using our own sales team, but we're working very hard on building our channel partner team. So we're expecting to see accelerated growth in the US by leveraging the new partnerships that we're setting up with organizations such as Security Scorecard. So Security Scorecard is a large cyber risk ratings platform and used by lots of organizations in the US in order to see their sort of cyber risk rating. So we're now a partner of Security Scorecard here on their marketplace. Their sales team are being enabled to be able to offer Stream as the risk management platform to work alongside Security Scorecard. They'll be able to see their scorecard ratings from within Stream. So that's just one of the partners we're working with. Tutela, which has the largest GRC consulting service in the US, or the largest team, largest number of team members that are focused on GRC. We're a partner of Tutela Solutions, so they'll be recommending our software alongside the services that they're offering to their customers. MasterCard Risk Recon, they offer a similar cyber risk rating solution in the same way that Security Scorecard do. And obviously MasterCard has a lot of awareness in the US, and so their sales team will also be able to sell stream. And it's not just in the US. I mean, globally, we're expanding that partner network, but we're working with Channel has a real multiplier effect on revenue because you can, you're using their sales teams, you're using their marketing teams and so on to raise that awareness of your product and your organization. So really excited about that channel.
Is the US pricing stronger than other parts of the world?
So pricing, average deal size for US clients will be slightly larger on average. So we would take at the moment $60K a year in average deal sizes for UK customers. So over the life of the contract, $180K. Whereas in the US, we're sort of expecting $80K to $90K. So they're slightly larger. And that's an average, of course, because we range from selling subscriptions that are $25K a year right up to sort of $250K a year. So that's a real average. But those are the average deal sizes that we're looking at.
Is that because the companies are bigger or you actually your pricing power is better in the US?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. Larger organizations and expectation from senior leadership teams and boards, you know, to invest in risk management software for the organization. So there's, you know, and there's, I mean, I would say when you look at the market, we're very, very competitive in terms of pricing of our software subscriptions. We try to be agile in terms of implementation. So one of our differentiators is that we obviously sell the subscription software, but we also our implementation services for other organizations in the marketplace could be taking them 2 years to configure and implement a risk management solution for their customers. Whereas we try to do that quite quickly and can do that quite quickly, you know, in sort of 2 to 6 months, you know, in an average of 3 months to get a customer seeing value from their risk management platform. But 3 month services is obviously not going to cost an organization as much as 2 years services. So our average deal size ticks over much more quickly.
Yeah, very good. So obviously the GRC side of things, you say, I think is a large market, isn't it? I think in 2022, it was something like $14 billion and forecast for something like $27 billion in 2027, which is obviously, it's a large increase. So do you feel the company Acuity is now poised to take just a small percentage of that?
Yeah, up to 100%. Yeah. And one of the ways that we're poised to do that is through very recognized partners. So we have selected the partners that we want to work with well, those that are really good, well-established brands in the market, and aligned ourselves with those organizations that have similar values to those that we would have, that they're long-standing and trusted in the marketplace. You know, and also, we have good reviews from review platform organizations and analysts. So Gartner, for example, you know, we on Gartner Peer Insights, we rate 4.8 out of 5. We are frequently mentioned in Gartner research by their analysts. You know, other influential research review platforms like G2, for example, you know, that's voted for by users of the software, and we constantly rank, you know, continually. I think we've had best support from our customers in our space for the last 3 quarters in a row, you know, so the market stands behind what we're saying, and we need to just continue to push forward. And we think we can do that at accelerated pace by working with partners that are very well established in the markets that we're interested in increasing our presence in, such as the US.
Yeah, so obviously you mentioned, you know, you've got that 45% of global demand is in the US, which is great. And you've got your channel manager and some of your sales partners in place there, ready to go. Have you got any plans or any anticipation for moving into maybe Asia as well in the future?
Yeah, so actually we have 2 partners that we're talking to at the moment in that region. So we're not excluding other regions where we say our focus is on the US, but, you know, we're not trying to boil the ocean at the same time. So when somebody comes, when we engage with a partner that's got, you know, again, is aligned with what we're trying to achieve, and it's saying, well, you're not in the right geographic location, so we will work with you. So we do actually have 2 partners in the age, well, 1 Australia, 1 in Asia at the moment, that are likely to come on board, you know, in the coming months. And so they will work on opportunities in that geographic location. We won't be putting direct sales teams on that region. But, you know, in the same vein, if a customer comes to us through our marketing efforts, in that region, we would work with them. But our partners also bring an advantage of local time zone, you know, support and so on. And so we're focusing on the US. And yes, you know, Asia, Middle East, those regions, and that our focus will switch to those once it's become kind of business as usual for us in the US.
What is the propensity to be able to expand quickly in terms of the company as a whole? I mean, if suddenly you managed to double the amount of customers you had, how would you cope?
So in our forecasting, we've planned very well in forecasting. So the plan has to be good. So we've given ourselves a budget target number, but also a stretch target number. And we do know, you know, if things are going in the direction that we want them to go and things are accelerating at more pace, we have made a plan for the resources that we would need in order to deliver, you know, the software and the service to the quality that we expect of ourselves. And so we think quite quickly, you know, we can expand the team to be able to meet those demands. We have, you know, long-standing relationships with selected recruitment organizations, for example, that knows the type of person that we would be looking to bring into the Acuity team. And so, yeah, we've planned that out. We've got a forecast for that one that we can put into action if the plans are going in that direction.
Over time. I mean, because the people who work in this type of business are not, you know, they're not everybody, are they? I mean, basically, it's pretty niche job in terms of what is required.
It is quite niche. So, you know, one of the things, again, that differentiates us from our competitors is the amount of experience that we have with the team, within the team. So our founders, you know, they came from a risk management background. That's where Acuity was born out of. Our consulting team, our sales team, support team will have some kind of regulatory experience, some kind of risk management experience. But more so these days, you're finding, you know, graduate level people with that type of experience. So, for example, one of our business development managers who joined us as a sales development rep, he did a cyber security degree. There are cyber security apprentice schemes now. There's risk management apprentice schemes. So actually the recruitment of people that have a good amount of base understanding of what risk or profiles organizations might be striving for is more common than you would think. But yes, we have to work with recruitment organizations that do searches specialized on, you know, reg tech, regulation technology, so that we can maintain that, you know, trusted advisor role that we have with our customers.
Okay, that all sounds very good. So from the point of view of staff retention, even yourselves, does the company have a share scheme or a scheme to keep the staff on board?
Obviously, our staff are really, really important to us. They're our most important asset. We've been working hard on the culture and how people interact with us as an organization, because if you're going through a period of accelerated growth, you know, you need to make sure that the employees are ready to come with you on that. So that's something that we've been putting a lot of focus on. But yes, in answer to the first question, there's a share option scheme. We had one already with Acuity, and with the transaction that's just been completed with Acuity Risk Management Group, we will have a new share option scheme for all employees, which gives them a long-term incentive to remain with the organization. Because like I say, you know, they are our most important asset, and we want to make sure that they continue on the journey with us. We do other things outside of that, you know, make sure that we have an all hands meeting once a month. We try and get the organization together. It's possible for us at the moment because we're an organization of 20, 21 people. As that grows, we may not be able to continue in that vein, but we'll certainly make sure that the team, you know, are continuing to get together and feel valued, because really important to us in terms of retaining those members of staff.
Well, sounds very exciting. And for any of the listeners who fancy making the investment, obviously the shares are trading on AIM under the ticker DRUM. Obviously, that may change in the future if there's a name change associated with Acuity, obviously, there. So, yeah, thanks very much for coming on, Kerry. It's been very interesting talking.
Thanks for having me. Great to meet you both, and hopefully we can do this again soon.
Thanks, Kerry.
So now let's move on to the week's movers and shakers. There's been some real winners in the past week, and sadly one or two losers. Starting with the loser, we've had Fusion Antibodies, FAB is the ticker. They announced a retail offer via the Rex platform, offering ordinary shares at 5 pence each. And just prior to that, they obviously issued a placing of 28 million shares, raising 1.42 million, and then a subscription of 2.74 million shares by directors and their families, raising an additional 137,000. Now, the retail offer, second placing, and subscription are conditional on the passing of resolutions at the general meeting set for the 8th of June. But the Rex retail offer is open to eligible UK investors and expected to close by 12 p.m. on the 22nd of May. If anyone's interested, then they would need to use AJ Bell Hargreaves Lansdown and Interactive Investor, because they're the participating intermediaries. And I think there's a minimum subscription of £50 per investor, and the total value of the shares available will not exceed £500,000. So I don't know. I mean, you know, considering this stock has been trading at about 96p on the 52-week high earlier in the day before this RNS was issued, it was at 34p buys were going through. To announce this such a discounted placing is a real kicker, Kev.
Yeah, it's almost ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, why as low as 5p?
I mean, there were 26 million shares outstanding before this, and that's one of the things. It was so tightly held, and then they went and issued another 28 million. They've effectively doubled the amount of shares outstanding just for a 1.47 million raise.
Yeah. No, I mean, the company effectively, they've raised pretty much what the company's worth. I don't know that, you know, ultimately. Yeah, I mean, obviously they're saying the management got behind it, but the management just took 10% of the company with 137,000 quid. So, well, not 10%, 5 or 6%. So, yeah, it's an absolute shocker, I feel, for anybody who's invested. I mean, looking at the share chats on London Southeast, I'll quote somebody. Let's be honest, they shafted the shareholders, bunch of clowns that they are. Mm. I mean, they've shafted their own shareholders.
Yeah, I mean, I know Paul...
I mean, they obviously needed the cash, but... Yeah.
If you read the RNS, it's very telling. They were pretty close to going in, that they were almost that completely out of cash. They were talking about, you know, going concern, and I think they were... Paul Warwick sent a message saying this company was pretty much finished.
Yeah. So this gives it another chance.
Yeah.
Assuming they get it over the line, that is, assuming people go for it. But as you say, maybe it had to just be that significantly discounted for people to actually put their hands in the pockets and say, okay, I'll go for 5p because, you know, it's already showing at 6, 7p and I'm going to be up on these 5p ones. So I might go for it. Yeah. But scary bananas.
I mean, I like the company and what they do and the technologies behind the antibodies, etc. And I think there's a really big use there. And if you look at the pharma stocks in the equivalent sort of companies in the US, they've got, you know, multiple million pound valuations. It's always a bit of a red flag when we try and get talk to someone in the company and they just don't come back and want to talk. That may not be, like, we've been trying for ages to get them on. And I'm always saying, well, why aren't they talking? I just don't understand it, really, because surely they want to get the message out to shareholders. I mean, Paul must be gutted.
They're based in Northern Ireland, aren't they, Fab?
Mm.
Well, good luck.
Yeah, I think, go on, give us some of the winners.
It's doubling down. I mean, what it does say to you is that in any, especially in this biotech situation, pharma scenario, that you need to be cashed up, okay? Yeah. And that's my big plug for them for Genflow. Genflow cashed up 2 years. They're basically talking about the enigma of life, in other words, to actually progress life either both longer and healthier. And, you know, if it works, it's going to be worth an absolute fortune. And right now it's, you know, I think only £10 million or something like that at 3p. Yeah. So anyway, moving on. Yeah, for me, rah-rah, Chill had a great week, up 50%. Great news come out. We interviewed Callum this week, so I won't go on about it, but listen to the Callum interview because, yeah, that says it all, I think. But basically, they've gone to progress the UK distribution scenario, and it's the same guys that distributed the Elf Bar around the UK. They get even a proportion of that market, and it's going to absolutely skyrocket as far as I'm concerned. And 50% really should only be the start of it. you know, this is going to be hundreds of millions of pounds company if this all gets sorted out correctly. You've got the UK, you've got the US, you've got the Middle East, which is going to be progressing as well. And you've got chill.com, which, as everybody now realizes and agrees, is one hell of a name and one hell of a, you know, system that you're going to move on to. And as more and more products go onto that, I can't see anything but revenue. Maybe we won't see massive revenues in the next sort of 6 months, but I think going forward, this is going to be huge. I really do think it's going to be huge.
Yeah, if we can get some really good distributors, and as announced this week with the vape company, and also get it out into different regions, then I think they've got a really good chance of getting some very good revenues coming in and profit as well, because, you know, the EBITDA on that should be good. So yeah, it looks very exciting. Share price, as you say, has really reacted well from the sort of 4p mark in the last sort of, let's say, 3 weeks or month up to the highs. I think it hit about 9.3, 9.4 on the Thursday session, and it's moved really well. So as you say, 48 to 50% up in the last week. Brilliant performer. So and it looks so
tight. Yeah, and we had a TR1 this week as well from Lloyd, actually below the 3%, but holding significantly more shares than he did hold. I think maybe as much as a million more shares. So he's on 8 point something million. And I know for sure in the background there must have been several people building big positions. So yeah, let's see what's going to happen, because it's not going to take many more people to think, I'm in this and try and build a position, and we're going to have another significant move upwards. So yeah, very exciting times. The other one which didn't react to the exciting news, but maybe it will, is African Pioneer. Fantastic news from Colin Bird about the products in Namibia, the copper gold in Namibia, 100% or 85% owned, I think, by African Pioneer. And then he went on to give us sort of chapter and verse. Again, listen to the interview yourselves. Went on to give us chapter and verse about, you know, the Sandfire stuff and what's the other company that they're dealing with, Sandfire and...
First Quantum.
And, like, he can hardly contain his excitement.
Yeah.
The scenario is that this company could have two majors doing effectively big deals with AFP, and it's worth more than the current market capitalization of African Pioneer.
Yeah, it's looking good.
You know, the one that they have themselves should value African Pioneer higher than it currently is. But again, Rome wasn't built in a day, but it's one of those ones that I think's under the radar.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen some of the stuff. Galileo is in the same boat as well. Galileo's cash or cash equivalent must be not far away in terms of the money coming from the sale that they did in South Africa. So, yeah.
The other one we had on this week was Peter Kruger, wasn't it, from Mass. They had what I can only describe as, if Carlsberg did JVs, that's what you get. It was phenomenal, wasn't it?
Yep, absolutely. £33 million being pumped into the company over the next year or so. And, you know, really what everybody wants.
£4 million cash as well, which is phenomenal.
Yeah, of that £33 million, they will receive £7.4 million cash because of all of the money they've already spent on all of those things. So if you think about that, it's 217 million shares and they're going to get 7.4 million cash. Do the maths in terms of what the share price should be. And it's currently 1.5p. And granted, they owe about 1.7 million. So you can take that off if you want. But then that values everything else at zero, you know, as in their 25% and anything they may do themselves and Pybridge and all of the other assets that they have. Some of them will go into the JV for sure, but, you know, they don't have to. And I think that's the negotiations that are taking place at the minute. And then once the JV is finalized, can't see it being this side of 3p, to be honest. Has to be worth more than that. Last week's bargain of the week was Ben.
How did that go this week?
That didn't go.
It was a bargain, was it, by the sounds of it?
It's still a bargain. It hasn't changed. It's still a bargain. Everybody's sort of looking at it and, yeah, the call price isn't doing us any favours at the minute and da-da-da. But come on, Avani, I haven't bought 29.9% just to look and smell the call. You know, I don't know what people need to understand. I mean, yeah, I'm not going to say anymore, but there you go. It's just, for me, completely bizarre. And again, I'm going to choose a bargain of the week again this week. And it's because of Colin's announcement this last week, and it's African Pioneer. African Pioneer is fundamentally undervalued in my book. It is crazy valuation for what they actually have with Sandfire, First Quantum, and now the copper gold in Namibia. It just doesn't make any sense that market cap is where it is. Doesn't make any sense at all.
Mm. The other one was talking about the ones that didn't perform too well. The shakers, we heard, obviously, we talked about, I think, last week, Purple Bricks, the once high-flying online estate agent that reached a peak valuation of more than £1.3 billion, has been sold to Charles Dunstan-backed rival Strike, who are also in a really bad position, for £1 with all of it.
For a quid.
£1 and 750 staff put at risk of redundancy. Company, which had threatened to shake up the property market with a low-cost model, went up for sale in February after issuing a string of profit warnings. Shares, obviously, in Purple Bricks plunged more than 40% on Wednesday, and it completely, the fire sale has all but wiped out shareholders.
Yeah, they did say that they kept something back, some of the cash back, didn't they?
Yeah, I think there was something like 5 million or something like that, they kept back for shareholders or something, but that pretty much 5.5 million in cash on its balance sheet to pay expenses and costs that were not covered by Strike, leaving shareholders around 2 million in proceeds from the sale.
Yeah, sad.
Sad state, and they do get wiped out. That's the reality. That's the reality in investing, isn't it? Unfortunately,
it is. It's a sad state of affairs, but it does happen. And I don't think it'll be the last one that's going to happen this year. And the scenario of that raise that you just talked about with Fab is basically staying alive raise, isn't it? It's as simple as that. So the companies that have managed to get raises away at a decent price are now sitting absolutely pretty, and their ability to even purchase other assets and do other things is vastly increased.
Yeah.
And that's going to help.
Yeah. As mentioned, the top performer of this week, 5 days to date, is Egdon Resources. They, EDR is the ticker, market cap of 23 million. They actually reached an agreement with Petricor Partners for an all cash takeover of Egdon for a cash consideration of 4.5p per share. The offer price was at a 96% premium to the closing price of 2.3 per share on the 16th of May, the day before the offer was made. Egdon directors have obviously recommended that shareholders vote in favour of the acquisition, so that's been a fantastic move this week, really.
What was the 52-week high of that share?
52-week high on Egdon was 9.2 pence.
Okay, so not fantastic if you've been in it for a while, but at the same time, fantastic from last week to this week. But yeah, it's a mover and shaker. Obviously, the other companies have bought it. Economies of scale, bringing in the production is going to help them.
The other one that did really well was IOG. We've mentioned them before on the podcast. Basically, they're progressing a drill campaign at the Blythe Field, and several key achievements were summarised there in the update to market this week. IOG is developing the Blythe H2 well to replace the existing Blythe H1 well to reduce water production. And the Blythe H2 well recently encountered a reservoir at 11,660 foot, and drilling will continue to 13,000 feet. And IOG is going to expect first gas from the H2 well later this year. So that moved from like sort of about 4.85p up to 7.5p. So good performer that, and it's good to see them finally getting that those wells under control.
Yeah, just a very, very quick update on our 12 stocks of 2023. We're currently 31% up in totality for the year. We've a couple of disappointing ones, and actually they would have been the two that I never would have guessed would have been disappointing. So that tells you why you need diversification in your portfolio. That's Prospect Energy and Jubilee Metals. I would not for one second have thought they would have been down here. But they're both basically 30 and 25% down, which I'm very surprised. And even the third one that's down is Ben's Creek, which is 12% down. Again, wouldn't have thought it in at all. Then we've got BSF Enterprises, which is 9% down. Again, that's been up nearly the whole year, except for the last few weeks, really. So then we've got Greatland Gold, who didn't have great news this week. And they're down 8.75%. Then we've got Galileo, who is pretty much flat. Contango Holdings, which is pretty much flat. We've got Sovereign Metals, which is flat. And then we've got four winners so far. Helium One up 23%, African Pioneer up 41%, Tech Minerals up 53%, and Chill Brands up 347%.
347.
So 347% from 2p to finished at 8.95 on Friday. So if you'd invested 10 grand in each, that was what the principal was, you had 120 grand and you've now got 157. So if anybody's 30% up on their portfolio this year, you're beating what we're doing. But I think there's a lot of room for improvement in a lot of those stocks. And yeah, we're hoping they're going to continue.
I think the only way that someone would beat that, the only way someone would beat that number is if they were just a one-hit wonder, a one-stock wonder, and they'd gone all in on a, you know, on one stock, and they'd seen a sort of, you know, 200-400% increase, you know what I mean, or something like that. Whereas if they've got a decent, diverse portfolio of between 5 and 10 stocks, it's hard to imagine many people, you know, doing better than that in this current climate.
If you'd put all your money or half your money in Chilled, then you definitely would be
good. For sure. Absolutely.
Such is life.
Yeah.
But we will do a more detailed thing of that at the end of June, which will be like the 6-month period. But just gives you an idea running. I mean, it's interesting because we were 30% up nearly, I think, after 6 weeks. Then we dipped way back down again and we were only 10, 12% up. And then slowly but surely over the last while, we've gone again. And yeah, now we're 31% up. So, yep, let's see where we can get to by the end of the year. Let's hope it's higher than that. And
you only need one or two more of those to go 5x, 10x, and you've done your quota. You know what I mean? That's all you need, really. Completely change the portfolio. Yep.
And the gold rings that we chose, the 5 gold rings, which we did say we thought were riskier bets. Effectively, we've got 2 that are up. Bonroy's up 17%. Blenco's up 23%. And the other 3, Extract's down 8%. East Star Resources is flat. And Alchemy Capital, worst performing, is 40% down.
Yeah.
So, again, we did say that there was a bit of risk involved. The whole portfolio is 1.63% down, okay, as it stands at the minute. But 2 weeks' time, that could be 30% up. That's the interesting thing because of the type of difference in those stocks that could happen. So anyway, just a quick overrun of that.
So anything else on the agenda for the next week? Obviously, you're over. We're going to do the couple of visits to some clients. We're going to see a couple of clients this week and we'll give update on that. I'm sure you'll hear the podcast and the relevant information will come out. Anything else looking forward to?
Not really. I mean, I just think the market is breathing now, whereas it was dying before. It's starting to breathe. And as we get a few more successes, then more and more things will breathe, I think, because the money will hopefully turn around and go into other stuff as well. So all of this stuff is good moving forward. And I actually expect a good second half of this year, to be honest. I think we're going to see stuff move.
Yeah, I'll leave you on this article. I was picked up the paper earlier on and I read this. It made me chuckle. Woman loses case after claiming XX in boss's email were kisses. An IT worker sued a boss for sexual harassment after he marked emails XX when he asking for more information, which she assumed were kisses. Karina Gasparova also told an employment tribune at London's Central Court that when Alexander Goulandris renamed a work file with his initials AJG, she believed it was an abbreviation for a jumbo genital. Her claims were rejected by the court, which said her perception of events had been skewed and she was ordered, he was ordered to pay £5,000 in costs. I mean, in all this, well, she thought it was a
good job she didn't say ABJ, isn't it? It really would have been a disaster.
I love the fact that she completely wasted the judge. The judge just went, I'm sorry, you're paying £5,000. just threw it out. Brilliant.
Well, you sent something. You sent something to me this weekend.
And it had something.
No, but you sent some picture to me in WhatsApp this week. That was what was it? It said,
"Is that
life is short. Make sure you spend as much time as possible on the internet arguing with strangers."
Brilliant, isn't it?
Which we just thought, brilliant. Let's all do more of that. Let's not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway.
All right. Good.
Well,
Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back next week with more podcasts.
Yeah, there's quite a few for you to listen to from this week as well. And yeah, I think it's very interesting, the one we did with drums and acuity today. So I hope you enjoyed that, and check it out, because I think that's going places, to be honest.
Very good. Speak soon.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.